Where's that? Yeah.
All right, something's singing here. Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Senate Public Safety Budget Division. It is February 24th, 2010. We have, as the first item on the agenda today, report from Ramsey County. If you remember that last year in our budget bill, we asked any county that was interested in looking at doing a pilot project for a revocation center. And Ramsey County has come forward with a very thoughtful proposal. And we thought that it would be a good thing to have on the agenda today. So if Mr. Crutchfield, Ms. Roberts, Mr. Erickson, Mr. Berge would all come to the table. And the report, members, is in your packet. And whoever's going to start, just go right ahead, please.
Madam Chair, I'm Carol Roberts. I'm the Director of Corrections for Ramsey County. Sitting to my left is Andy Erickson, who is the Deputy Director for Adult Services. To my right is our Assistant Superintendent for the Ramsey County Correctional Facility, and to my far right is Chris Crutchfield, who is our liaison for external affairs. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Senators. Ramsey County, as you said, submitted a proposal for a pilot revocation center in response to Minnesota session laws of 2009. Each year, Ramsey County supervises approximately 1,400 to 1,500 offenders per year who are returned to the community on supervised release status. Our monthly caseload, snapshot in time, is we have upwards of 770 offenders at any given time. Last year, from January 2009 through January 2010, we had 88 individuals who were returned to institutions based upon rearrest, and 116 individuals who were returned to correctional prisons for technical violations of their supervised release status. Therefore, we are returning more people to prison for technical violations than for actual rearrest. The request from the legislature for a concept for a revocation center presents a real opportunity to break down and look at technical violators, to understand them better, and to challenge some of our assumptions, apply evidence-based practices to the situation, to perhaps obtain better outcomes for these offenders than is presently the case. If we can't conceive of a different way of doing business, if we can't even conceive of it, how are we going to do business differently? How can our future be any different than what it is now, and that we wind up preserving the status quo? A word of caution that I would give before I proceed. We believe it is important to bring new thoughtful concepts forward, whether it is funded now or in the future. We are not here to ask for a handout. We are here to say we think that we have an idea that is worth pursuing at some point in the future. It is meant to be a suggestion for a test of a model to see if we can get better outcomes. Such a project would lead, if successful, would lead to development possibly of a replicable model which could be used throughout this state. And then we can talk about saving real dollars in our budgets. This is not going to save us. This project, even if it was done today, is not going to save us scads of money. What it would do is say, this is a different model that might be more cost-effective and get us better outcomes than we are presently getting. Basically, the proposal calls for a small portion of eligible Ramsey County technical violators to be diverted from prison to the Ramsey County Correctional Facility. offenders would be given the choice of a revocation hearing or having their supervision restructured to include conditions which specifically outline requirements and responsibilities of participation at the revocation center. The Department of Corrections, through its HRU, would maintain their traditional role as gatekeeper for approving any such restructuring arrangement. The focus of the program, we are particularly interested in, as I said, individuals who are in technical violation of their probation. But more specifically, we're interested in drug and alcohol abuse, individuals who have drug or alcohol issues, who have antisocial attitudes, who have employment or school issues, and individuals who associate with antisocial others. All of these are robust predictors of ongoing criminality. The Ramsey County Correctional Facility is positioned to be able to provide drug treatment services, to conduct cognitive groups to address antisocial attitudes, and to teach certain skills, like problem-solving skills, to teach what alternatives might be for offenders. Very often our offenders have not got the skill set to make decisions. They don't even know that there are alternatives to what it is that they are doing. We're able to conduct job readiness groups as well as for well-performing offenders and to help them in their job search and in some cases to provide supportive employment and housing opportunities. Through our network of volunteers, and we have quite a number of volunteers, over 200 who work at our correctional facilities, we hope to expose them and link them with pro-social others in the community. Likewise, we're able to engage, because we're situated in the community from which these offenders come, we're able to engage the family and positive support systems in their supervision. Lastly, we are capable of linking offenders to treatment in the community. And that's been a change in focus at the correctional facility over the last 4 to 5 years. We really are focused on getting people out, what happens to them after they leave our facility. And I would give you two examples. We have structured our drug treatment program such that part of the program is delivered in the institution and the other part is delivered out in the community. Likewise, for job readiness and employment, part of that job readiness is done inside the institution. And if people really do comply and do well with that, we release them each day to go job seeking with one of our community partners. The program will be designed to target those risk factors of these people, which, if unaddressed, will likely lead to ongoing criminality. And there's also an accountability component. People can earn some freedom, again, to do the job searches and the like based upon their performance. Likewise, they can lose it. If anyone who's given an opportunity to do a job search with our community partners, for instance, abuses that opportunity, back they will come into the institution. What is unique about this proposal and what sets it apart from perhaps other approaches? That would be treatment is a requirement. You don't have a choice. If you want to participate in this program, you have got to agree to do the full program and to participate in it fully. You earn your privileges. Abuse of privileges is dealt with immediately. Evidence-based practices are used throughout. Continuous involvement of the field probation officer who knows that particular offender and who will work closely with institutional staff. Community supports will be put in place. Linkages to services in the community, as I just said, in the case of employment or in the case of drug treatment. A family and kinship network, to the degree that they are willing, will be part of the program to provide appropriate support for our work. The program will be adaptable in that it is able to change quickly. It's able to change its operations based upon its experience. And lastly, it marries accountability in positive terms to treatment and proceeds on the basis, and this is really important, it's not social worky, it is what produces a result. It proceeds on the basis that people are capable of positive change. There are basically four stages of the program. People will move through assessment to goal setting and treatment and to transition. Each step, each movement through each stage has to be earned. Madam Chair, my colleagues are present at the table to answer any questions that you might have about the program specifically, as am I.
Thank you. You didn't address the cost.
We think that it is about $60 to $65 a day.
And does that include the treatment and all the other working with community and all of those as well?
Yes, it does.
That's good. Did I understand correctly that part of the day would be not in the workhouse, it would be out working in the community?
Yes, but that would have to be earned. You'd be in initially, but you would have to show compliance with the treatment that is going on at that center before you would be considered to do that.
Okay. Senator Moi.
Physically, where would the program be housed?
Senator Moi, it would be housed at the Ramsey County Correctional Facility.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
And we have the bed space for that?
Excuse me?
Do we have the physical capacity for that?
Senator Moore, yes, we do.
And Madam Chair?
Senator.
I am really intrigued by the principles behind it, and I really like the risk needs and assessment piece of it because I think that that's really critical in order to be comprehensive. Built into that piece of it, are there some particular attention being paid to whether one of these individuals is male or female? And do we pay attention to that? And is that something that would be significant?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, I think
Berge.
At this, and my name is Ron Berge, Assistant Superintendent. I think in this proposal, we were talking about men. We also have a facility for women at the Ramsey County Correctional Facility, have since October of 08 had the Ramsey County women there. But this model was designed, you know, at this point to just deal with the men.
Madam Chair, and Ms. Bird, is that because there are so few women that we don't need this kind of program in place, or?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, without the exact figures, I'm going to say yes, that would be the case. Although I have to say that the facility has a really excellent program for women offenders as is, but the mass to be able to do this wouldn't make sense for us, and it's really the men who are the overwhelming folks who are on supervised release.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? I think it says that you're going to focus heavily on property, drug, and DWI offenders.
Madam Chair, we're particularly interested in drug and alcohol offenders. We have no desire to try to handle every kind of technical violator that might be out there. We really need to focus on, we want to focus on those characteristics of these offenders that have a high probability of having them be involved further in the criminal justice system by virtue of rearrest. And so we'd really like to target well. If we were to target wide, it would be many more resources. We'd like to try it with one kind of population, basically.
And you would serve kind of the metro area, or were you thinking just Ramsey County?
We'd like them to be, Madam Chair, we would like them to be Ramsey County residents.
Right, County residents. Okay. So their county of origin when they went to went to prison, or where they are when they come home. I mean, I assume in some cases that might be different.
I think we had, Madam Chair, I believe we had in mind that it would be the county of commit. Although, if we were doing the supervision, we could envision a situation where we would take others in.
And then talk a little bit more about the length of time. I think last year we put into law that a revocation or nobody goes back for more than 90 days. And you've got it structured at like a 90-day or thereabouts program. So that fits into that qualification?
Madam Chair, we don't. And there is the rub, and perhaps at some point in the future, a subject for future discussion. One of the big issues with providing treatment for any correctional population is what's called dosage. Do they get enough? Is there enough? There is no such thing as a program light. If you're going for a program light, you're likely not to produce the results that you're really looking for. If you're really cooperating with this program, you could get out in 85 days. You could be done. However, at the extreme, it's 125 days if you're not cooperating.
Have you talked to the Department of Corrections at all about this proposal?
Just, Madam Chair, just very lightly about what we were looking to put forth. And as I said, it was more important for us to put forth another way of viewing the world as something possible that you might look at, if not now. And we really had no great hope that it would be now, at least at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other questions? Well, I think this is a really thoughtful presentation, and I'm really intrigued by it. I'm especially intrigued because the cost per day is including treatment and including a work plan and not just warehousing somebody. And I'm sure we will have conversations going forward about this. I like it a lot.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Have Hennepin in it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley, then Senator Wong.
Madam Chair, on the small amount that would go to the the cost of the per diem, it seemed quite low. Are you convinced that you can do that for $56 or whatever?
Well, I believe in the original Senator, Madam Chair, we originally said $60. We think that it's more like $60-$65 in that area.
Senator Moore?
You know, Madam Chair, I have to say that I'm really proud of what the county is doing, and I think that you were also part of the hearing that we had on the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative, mm-hmm. which is yet another county government-initiated initiative that didn't take us mandating it or compelling them to do it. Our local governments have been very thoughtful in helping us to reinvent how we do things, and this is yet another fine example of how we have great professionals who are doing this in the front line who are rethinking about how we can do public safety safely, smartly, and that is fiscally sound. And I think that this is a really great project, and I hope that other counties will shamelessly steal the ideas.
You know, Senator Moore, yesterday I was having a conversation with one of the county commissioners in Hennepin, and I was struck by just how much more nimble the counties seem to be than state government. I always think that state government is so much more nimble than federal government, but, you know, the closer to the people, the more nimble the government can be, and they're working on a lot of great projects, and Ramsey, this is a great proposal. And
Madam Chair, if you wouldn't mind me saying, I would really be remiss. Yes, I believe that there is a lot of great work going on in the counties, but I would be really remiss if I didn't say that the Department of Corrections has really created some opportunities for us in this state mm-hmm. to learn. They have brought in federal consultants to understand what's going on around the country, to understand what the research is. And the commissioner has created an environment in which we can all come together and talk about evidence-based practices and collaborate. I think you'll see that there is much more collaboration going on in this state than ever before among all the correctional delivery systems in the state, and that focus really has come from the commissioner, and so I'd be remiss if I didn't say that.
Thank you. That's a good reminder to us. I appreciate that. So anything else you want to add? Thank you all.
Thank you.
Second half of our hearing today is taking public testimony on the governor's supplemental budget proposal. We got information Monday. It was Monday, right? Monday about that, and I believe your spreadsheets are still in your packets if you put them there. And we have several people who have signed up to talk to us today, and so Mr. Zickmund from the Fire Association Coalition, I think, is the first on the list. There he is.
That's what happens when you pay $3 for them. Yeah, somewhere I bet I do too. Yeah. I think they're just cheap.
Sorry. Whenever you're ready to start, go right ahead, please.
Madam Chair, Senate members, my name is Dan Winkle. I'm going to start, and Niall will get his opportunity, but I'm the fire chief from the city of Andover and the president of the Minnesota State Fire Department Association. We are here today to talk to you about the proposal, the supplemental budget proposal, and what it has done to a fire safety account that we had established by this body and signed by the governor back in 2006. The fire service came to the legislators looking for a way to fund our fire marshal's office, some firefighter training, and some of our regional response teams that are critical to what we do every day in our business. We thought we were very creative back then and have established a service fee that goes on to homeowners insurance premiums to pay for this fund. So we're not talking about general tax dollars here, general fund dollars. These are service fees that are collected on fire insurance premiums. And again, that was done 2006. So I'm gonna give you a little more history. There are 20,000 firefighters in the state of Minnesota. About 18,000 of them are paid on call or volunteer, and about 2,000 are full-time or career firefighters. Obviously, as the biggest part of our jobs is training. We respond to any kind of incident, from home explosions in Edina to rescues in silos to wildfires in our boundary waters. And in order for us to be able to respond to those types of calls, we have to spend an awful lot of time and dollars doing training. I know in my own department, we spend about 20% of the firefighters' times that they're there on fire training. And I would guess that's pretty consistent across the board, that that is a big time commitment. There are about 220 hours now of the initial firefighter training that every firefighter has to go through. 20 years ago, we could probably get by with maybe 10 hours or 15, and they'd put you on the truck, and I hate to admit I go back a little farther than 20 years, but when I started, it was learn how to get on the truck, and we'll pull some hose and do what you can do with it, but that's not the case anymore. We have minimum standards that every firefighter has to go through, and again, right now we're looking at 220 hours. Most of this will happen in the first year or two, and then, of course, there's ongoing recertification and training that firefighters will do for the rest of their career. So training is a huge issue for us. And I just want to reemphasize what these funds are used for. We do contribute to the general fund. That was part of this fund when we put it together. We did agree to that. We, in addition to that, we fund the fire marshal's office, a number of hours of firefighter training, as well as our regional response teams, which include hazmat, structure collapse, and any specialty teams that are out there. And we'd like to think that an incident like that will never happen, one of those specialty types of calls, but you all know that it does happen, and firefighters are always going to be called. Anytime you see an emergency issue out there, seems there's a firefighter someplace. And if they're not trained, they should not be responding to that. Interesting facts is that, according to the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, a study done a couple of years ago, Minnesota ranks 45th in the country per capita for expenditures for the fire service. So we're in the bottom 10% of the dollars per capita that we spend on firefighter services. And I'm not sure if we should be proud of that or not. We're pretty low when it comes to that. We don't have a lot of, in fact, very little state dollars are spent at all on firefighter training or fire services. We have not been here asking for a lot of things, but this is near and dear to our heart. This is critical that we have these funds for this fire safety account so that we can continue to train our firefighters as we have to do. You know, without the training, we run the risk of injuries and, heaven forbid, firefighter deaths. We want to make sure that our people are trained properly so they can do the jobs that we sign up to do. I think both Niall and Ted have other comments, but we'll stand for questions, of course, Madam Chair, afterwards, if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Winkle.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Ted Vanderbeek. I am the Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, the full-time career side of the fire service. This surcharge that was added averages $5.20 per policy holder here in Minnesota. Anticipated generation is going to be about $13 million a year. The need here in Minnesota is more than double that amount, estimated at $28 million annually in the state for identified needs. Half of Minnesota firefighters in this state are not trained and certified to the minimum standards. Many communities cannot afford the training or have that availability. This surcharge puts the money directly to those communities that are in need. Part of these unfunded mandates include many of their national standards, your OSHA standards, NFPA standards that are required, such as hazardous materials, just even the simplest right to know for those responders that are there before the hazardous materials teams are called. Things as simple as their breathing apparatus and their personal protective gear, operation of apparatus, and even things as simple as HR training that deals with diversity and sexual harassment and workplace issues. Many cities don't even have the funding to do that. This will allow them. These training dollars are really important, and ever since 9/11, the federal government has put out a lot of mandates and training. There was a huge firefighter loss because of training in Charlotte, North Carolina, that took 7 firefighters' lives for lack of training. That state has made changes, and every time an incident like that happens in the country, the federal government will come down with mandates, they'll start the program, inkle a little money, and then there's no more money. And in the future, we'll be relying on this surcharge to help us do our jobs. And we think if we lose it, it would be a travesty. And we're asking for consideration to maintain it. By giving us that money, you're helping us do our jobs, not only keep ourselves safe, but the communities in which we respond to. No matter what, the fire service has always been there. When people call or anybody calls, we will come. We just would like a little extra training on some of the changing aspects of our job, which has gotten more complicated, and more structured in the last decade.
Thank you. Mr. Zickman.
Madam Chair, members, Niall Zickman representing the Minnesota Fire Chiefs, about 2,000 members, of which all but 50 or 60 are volunteers, again, because we're predominantly a volunteer state. I'm going to confine my remarks to those state teams. And when we talk about those, we're talking about 3 teams specifically: the chemical assessment teams, the people that come out and deal with the hazards, the bad stuff, if you will, the decontamination trailers, and then the structural collapse specialty rescue. I'll start with the decontamination trailer. There's 15 of those that were placed throughout the state, primarily using federal funds. since those came in, bought the trailers, put the inventory in them, there's been no state dollars. Those trailers are now actually no longer in the control of the state. They're out in 15 regions. We've got a pretty good sense that they're out there and operational, but we don't know for sure. There's been no training. There's been no maintenance money. There's been no insurance money. They're all being operated locally within those regions in whatever fashion they're able to sustain. We don't know what the cadre of supporters are. And for the first time, there's enough money to finally put some revenue or some funds to those trailers and be able to use those. An example of where they would be used, if you have a decontamination or you have a contamination incident, I use Blaine Senior High, 3,500 people are in that building. If there's an incident, they're not going to go to any hospital because they'll contaminate that hospital. They have to be decontaminated on site. 40 people would mess up a system. I think the chemical assessment, the hazardous material teams are self-explanatory. One of those teams is in the city of St. Paul. They're spread throughout geographically, St. Cloud, Rochester. Again, they're all targeted for a portion of the state. They're all being locally subsidized. They're state teams. They do get modest annual operating revenue, but it's not sufficient enough, primarily to the training needs. And last but not least are the structural collapse or Strike Force One, which is the state's response. Again, federal funds created those teams, but there's been no state money to do the ongoing training. Originally, there was over a couple hundred individuals that were retrained with that federal money. Since then, that number is somewhere about half of that, because unless that local department could sustain that training, they've simply gone to the wayside. That is our response. The next closest team, if you will, is coming out of Indiana. There's always an expectation that the state will provide the first 24 to 72 hours of response. So I'd just like to close with, none of this money is going into the firefighters' pockets. It's simply going to enable us to do our job safer and better. Since we've kept records in the state, 1881, 200 firefighters have lost their lives. In the past decade, we've lost 10 firefighters. Eight of those 10 have been volunteers who receive little or no compensation, and they're simply asking, do you have those training dollars to keep them safe? So we're aware, we're not immune to the challenges that are facing the legislative body, but again, this money is coming from your homeowners and going to your firefighters, and we need it. We need it desperately. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and we can hope we can count on your support.
Thank you all. We also have a letter in your packets, members, from the League of Minnesota Cities about the fire safety account. Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to speak on the fire safety account? We can just kind of add them to it. See anybody? Senator Ingebrigtsen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe this could be directed to all three of you, but I know the retention of volunteers in the state is becoming a very huge issue. This certainly is not going to help that. Would that be your answer? I'm a young man that comes to town, and I want to become active.
Been young for a long time.
Well, I'm using Senator Limmer as an example. Then. Very young guy coming to town with a young family, want to become community active, and I want to join the fire department. I go in there and I look at this equipment. I go, whoa, this is some pretty heavy stuff for me to have to run, and to hear the information come from the fire chief saying, well, we'd like to train you, but we really don't have any money right now. Isn't that going to be a real huge issue when we're talking about retention, getting new volunteers? Because I know it's getting to be big.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'll just give you a brief statistic. The state auditor tracks the volunteers through the pension system. Fully 74% of the volunteers in the state are over the age of 35. 20%, or one-fifth, are over age 50 and could retire today. So we've got a crisis on our hands in terms of staffing alone. I'll let Chief Winkle, who's president of the Fire Department Association, talk about the challenges of training and retaining those new members we do get in the door.
Chief Winkle?
Madam Chair, Senator, first I'd like to say thanks. It's nice to see you at our regional meetings. I know you've gone, and we appreciate you being out there listening to your firefighters. Had an opportunity to talk with you a couple of times in the past. But recruitment is becoming absolutely a huge issue for us. Across the board, and I think training-wise, as a new recruit, I think it will help a little to understand that, hey, at least they're doing the appropriate training. It's going to make me feel a little more comfortable that I should be safer and that I'm going to be able to go home to my family after the event. So I think there is a lot of value in the appropriate training. And if they can't do the training, that will certainly be a retention issue for sure, because I think we will lose members saying, I just don't feel comfortable. I don't know what I'm doing. The chief is telling me I don't have money to give you more training, additional training. And I think that is going to be a huge issue. I truly do, if that answers your question.
That does. Thank you.
Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief, probably one of your problems could or should be dealing with the fact that people are not living in town or available from a workforce to help take care of the incident.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, 90% of our firefighters in the state of Minnesota are volunteer or paid on call, and you're absolutely correct. It's a struggle for every fire department out there to maintain staffing 24 hours a day, unless there's a career department, and even they have their issues some days. But across this state, we run into significant issues of fire departments who might have, whether depending on their size, of course, but 80-90% of their members got to go to work during the day, some evenings, of course, but they're gone. They're out of the city a lot of the time. And so that is a significant problem that we have to deal with. We do help, or we try to help local cities with recruitment, but that's getting more difficult with the time commitments that the firefighters have to put into all of the functions and the training that we do. It is hard to get new people. But as Chief Zickman referred to earlier, the numbers we're looking at of those that can retire or leave the fire service today is significant. And we are going to have to look at that, and consequently, we'll need a lot of money, support, in training of new firefighters. It's going to be a big problem for us.
Senator Moore. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chief, or to any of you on the panel. I, you know, for the last several cycles, I have been particularly sensitive to the impact of the cuts in local government aid to our fire departments and our police departments at the local level. And, you know, the one thing that in this committee I've been able to kind of go home excited is because the fire safety account comes in to help mitigate against some of the things that we need to do for our guys. And so I guess, I mean, when I saw the numbers the other day, I couldn't breathe for thinking that once that's gone, and we don't know what's going to happen to the other underlying budgetary resources. I guess my question to you is, are there some areas in the state of Minnesota that is going to be so profoundly affected by the multiple convergence of all these cuts that we're putting people's safety into jeopardy?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore. I just want to share with the committee, one of the, I think, great strategies of the fire safety account for the training is its reimbursement. And so it helped guard against the local government aid cuts, which we're all experiencing, we're all sharing in. I think a lot of folks think, oh, public safety is not sharing the cut. We are sharing in the cut. But you don't get this money unless you spend it and do the training and get reimbursed. But to answer your question specifically, I've been using the example of Crane Lake, Minnesota. I have some friends up there. I know the fire chief. They were on a 5-year plan to train their folks to Firefighter 1. Now, Chief Winkle and I do that in 6 months, but 5 years. So if you do travel into rural Minnesota, are you at greater risk? Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, who's going to show up? It's going to be the local fire. That's the only people there. And as we travel around the regionals, Chief Winkle and I, the 15 regions, we routinely heard firefighters stand up. We just had them share their annual training budget. We heard $1,000 and $2,000 for the entire department for an entire year. That was the norm, not the exception. So that's why we're so passionate about, you know, this issue, because we travel around the state ourselves, and we want that protection.
How many fire departments do we have in the state?
I see the fire marshal in the audience. You'll correct me if I'm wrong, Madam Chair. 797. 787. I knew he would correct me.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really wasn't going to say much, but Senator Ingebrigtsen mentioned my name, and now I got to get involved in this.
Oh, no, is this going to be long?
Maybe. You asked for it. I am not in support of anyone raiding any existing fund in anything in state government. And we've begun to see the direction of raiding funds in a variety of departments. Any licensed profession has usually some type of fund balance. And if it's not of a public nature, the private nature of our licensed professions have a fund for protecting the consumer in the event of a loss. It's a temporary fund, but it helps, and it's geared toward protecting the consumer and to restore them quickly until the funds are gotten from another source. And some of those funds now have already been raided as of last year. One thing that I also oppose. The question I have is, I thought that in tax policy, when it comes to levying taxes, a city does have an opportunity to levy a tax in order to fulfill the needs for public safety. And they do not have to go, they can exceed a levy authority if they wish, that it's an opportunity for them to address the needs of public safety. Where is the problem with that? If I'm correct, the cities have an opportunity to raise that funding on their own.
Sure.
Am I misguided on that assumption? And then if that's true, why are you coming to the state for that reimbursement when I think maybe cities should step up to it?
Right. I can answer that, Madam Chair and Senator.
Mr. Vanderbeek.
What?
Are you a chief, too?
No, I'm on. I'm actually a line firefighter out of St. Paul here.
Okay, sorry.
22 years. One of the things that happens, and we've seen these LGA cuts, and I'll give you a perspective here where Minneapolis is facing with the LGA cuts. Across the board, anywhere from 8 to 10% of their overall budget. Most of the budget in your larger cities where you have your full-time firefighters, St. Paul, Minneapolis, between the two cities, probably respond to almost 100,000 calls a year. We're over 50,000 here in St. Paul because we also respond to all the medicals. When you cut that amount of money, a lot of your overall budget is wages, salaries to maintain 24/7 staffing. And then the budgets are broke up. One of the things that happens is they try to maintain what we've seen is there hasn't been an increase in levy because the local officials didn't jump on that last year to increase the levy. One thing they did do in our city in St. Paul is they went with status quo. Nobody lost their jobs. But this next round is going to hit really deep. In Minneapolis alone, Tom Thornburg, who is also president of State Association, they're looking at a 10% cut. They're talking about laying off 40 firefighters just with those kind of cuts. Well, that would be quite a levy increase just from the fire department to restore that. One of the first things that gets hit is to minimize the training. I mean, because we train a little more often and we're trained very intensely in the first year or two of employment. They want us to rely back on that, but there's so many things that have changed in the fire service and what we respond to that we need that additional training. I mean, there's new pieces of equipment that require maybe 16, 20 hours of training per individual to be able to use that piece of equipment efficiently, safely, and really know how to operate it. I don't think for training purposes that when the cities and the fire departments are looking at just maintaining their staffing and what they provide to those communities, they're not tapping on any additional dollars for training. And that's why we had come to the legislature a few years back to get it as a surcharge so it was dedicated to training those individuals, not only like for myself and those that are in the larger cities that are the career firefighters, but also in outstate Minnesota. Just, I mean, there's things that can happen in Effie, Minnesota, in the north, that could happen here. And those firefighters should be trained. Even if it's as a hazardous materials incident and one of the response team is coming, they still have to have enough knowledge to recognize the situation, keep themselves and those people safe till those teams arrive, and they need that training.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, thank you. As I've listened to this discussion over the years, I sometimes come to the conclusion that if a city council can't recognize a priority of public safety in their budget, there's something wrong with the discussion. Now, one thing I've learned is that sometimes there's a rate of scale that you can't necessarily accomplish in a small community. Larger ones might be easier to accomplish and take care of their own public safety budgets, even and especially with kind of an open check. If they wanted to, they could install their own levy authority for that purpose. But have you considered perhaps your bill to draw a line somewhere on smaller cities would be available for state funds as opposed to everyone across the board being that we've got tight budgets ourselves and we're trying to figure out, and we renew this discussion every year as the budgets get tighter, what is the real priority of governing? And public safety, at least from my interpretation of the Minnesota Constitution, public safety is number one, found in Section 1 of the state constitution. So I have to raise the question of have we thought of anything to draw the line of cities that need that help in accomplishing the scale so that their citizens are kept safe and the richer cities would have an opportunity perhaps to take care of it themselves.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Zygmunt.
Senator Limmer, I think we've done exactly that. The focus of this account was first and foremost restoring funding to the state fire marshal's office, which disproportionately benefits rural Minnesota, as the metro area, the Owatonnas, the Moorheads, have the staff and the resources to hire fire inspectors, fire investigators. The fire marshal's office is providing those inspections of schools, lodging facilities, prisons, et cetera. Imagine a local jurisdiction trying to shut down a local school. Okay, the investigations, again, all that's being funded through the state fire marshals, and that's where the lion's share of this money is going. The second identified was the regional response teams. Again, that's a statewide issue, and why would the city of Blaine want to subsidize and fund a statewide team beyond what they should do? The third, then, was that training, because it is for a greater good. Chief Winkle and I aren't going to sit here and tell you from Andover and Blaine that this is going to solve our training budget problem. Between the two of us, we got 8,000 out of 1.2 million. The reality is the rural departments are 787. They make up 740 of those 787 departments. They're going to take the lion's share. So I think we've done that just through the system. We are sending it out to where it's needed most. And in fact, if the money is not appropriated, it will disproportionately hurt those small departments on the training because they've got the numbers. There's 740 of them. So I think we've made that calculation, and we've designed the system to, in fact, benefit those folks.
Ms. Finn, do you want to weigh in on this discussion?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I just wanted to respond to Senator Limmer, your initial question, which was whether or not cities could levy over and above the levy limit to pay for public safety services. And in fact, you're correct. We can, and I think some cities probably do. What I did also want to share with you, though, is the fact that, you know, we supported the creation of this account as a way of taking some of the pressures off of the local property taxpayers. And we think that since it's being collected for that purpose, we would like to see it used that way. It's a line item on the homeowners and property owners' insurance, and that's the purpose for which it's collected. The other thing I just would like to mention is that, I didn't articulate this very well in the letter that was distributed today, but There are multiple pressures on local budgets right now. So even if cities can levy over and above for fire service and other public safety needs, the costs elsewhere are going up. They're paying higher premiums for health insurance for their employees. Our costs for public pensions are escalating. Our energy costs are up. And frankly, you know, anything that we can't cover through this account is going to be borne by the property taxpayer. And for some, that's very troubling. Thank you.
Right. Anybody else want to talk about the fire safety account? Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
It looks like domestic violence is the next category that we have here. Donna Dunn from MnCASA. And why doesn't Ms. Denmark come up at the same time?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Donna Dunn, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, or MnCASA. MnCASA provides education, training, and advocacy for Minnesota's sexual violence service programs and represents over 70 member programs throughout the state. We serve as a voice for victims and survivors of sexual violence and concerned citizens committed to stopping sexual violence in Minnesota. I'm here today to just offer some brief comments about the potential impact of reductions in the sexual assault grant program. I've distributed general summary information about the program to committee members, and I will limit my comments to two things. One, describing what we are learning from our members about the likely on-the-ground impact of reductions, and two, offering suggestions about how to minimize the impact of any reductions. The governor's supplemental budget recognizes the sexual assault grant program as a core public safety service and doesn't recommend any reductions. However, we do appreciate the legislature's need to consider all options in crafting a proposal to deal with the state's chronic budget deficit. Well, we asked our programs to tell us how a 3% or a 6% cut in state funding might affect their ability to serve their communities. Please keep in mind that we're talking about relatively small programs or agencies, and that the average size of a sexual assault program is about program grant is about $40,000 to serve a county in Minnesota. Here's what we learned from our programs about the potential impact of likely cuts. First of all, budgets are already stretched. As one program described the situation, we are already asking for donations for office supplies. And we have cut the continuing education and training budget for our five-person staff to a total of $300. I would just comment on that sexual assault is a very complex issue, and not having enough money to provide ongoing professional development to staff is a concern. Another program noted we recently downsized from four to three staff and reduced our executive director salary to a part-time equivalency. Secondly, programs depend upon volunteers to staff crisis lines and to transport victims to crisis intervention services. Reductions in mileage and expense reimbursement for volunteers will make it difficult to meet the state grant program expectations for providing 24-hour access to these services. Cuts in mileage budgets will also require staff in Greater Minnesota to more rigidly limit travel to accompany victims to critical medical or legal appointments or for service planning. Even small cuts have a great impact on a program's ability to leverage those volunteer contributions. And often that contribution, as you might recall from a testimony last year, we heard from a program that identified that the volunteer contribution hours to their program resulted, in effect, in doubling their staff availability, their advocacy availability to the community. And then finally, staff hours will be reduced. This is most likely to result in the elimination of risk reduction or community prevention and education services. In short, program capacity to deliver basic services is crumbling. The core service of 24-hour access to crisis intervention support is threatened, and even the most basic sexual violence awareness and prevention education activities are being set aside already. Recent budget decisions by the legislature suggest an understanding and a recognition of both the importance and the vulnerability of local sexual violence programs. In 2007, the legislature approved a 2% permanent increase in funding for these programs, as well as a 2% one-time increase. This was the first increase for these services in 10 years, and we were very pleased. Facing budget reductions last year, the legislature directed the Department of Public Safety to protect direct services by capping cuts to sexual violence grants at 3%. With the help of federal stimulus dollars, the department demonstrated its commitment to trying to minimize the effect of coping with budget challenges on direct services for victims and survivors by allocating some of their federal stimulus dollars to temporarily minimize those cuts. So protecting the core integrity of sexual assault victim services will require a similar approach. Programs will need, if there is such a cut, to find ways to absorb those cuts. And the legislature and the department will need to clearly acknowledge this means a temporary reduction or elimination of certain services that are currently required as a part of state contracting. Additionally, the department, as it has done in the past, may need to set aside some of its non-critical activities in order to minimize the reductions in grant funding for those critical direct services in our counties and towns and cities across the state. Well, in closing, I'd like to remind the committee that we are having the conversation today about doing what we can do to minimize harm to the system of small, community-based programs providing assistance to nearly 10,000 victims of sexual violence in Minnesota each year. We don't have a choice. The conversation we need to be having is how to make these programs stronger, how we are going to address the fact that 13 Minnesota counties and 5 of the state's reservation continue to go without any state-supported services for victims of sexual violence. But that's one conversation we will need to unfortunately wait for another day. Thank you for the opportunity to contribute to the budget deliberations.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. Questions? Mm-hmm. Okay, Ms. Denmark?
Hi.
Whoever is going
to speak. Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tal Mae Shong, and I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I'm the public policy specialist there. And I'm going to do a quick introduction of the handout that was passed out and then also introduce Ms. Denmark. MCBW represents over 84 member programs across the state, including shelters, safe home networks, community advocacy programs, criminal justice intervention projects, and other organizations working to end domestic violence. I have one handout for you today, which is the 2009 Femicide Report. This report documents the murders of women, children, and men as a result of domestic violence and provides an analysis of some of the continuing issues we are facing in Minnesota in our efforts to respond more effectively to abusers and to provide protection for victims. While the Femicide Report illustrates the grave and sometimes lethal nature of domestic violence, we're doing many things right in Minnesota, and we're making progress. I'm here today with Jennifer Denmark, a survivor of domestic violence from Scott County, Minnesota, who is going to speak more intimately about a system response that is working in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Denmark.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Denmark, and I'm so very grateful to be here with you today to share my story about how the system worked and the critical need for funding for domestic violence programs in Minnesota. I am the mother of 3 and the director of a preschool program. My story is similar to those of the women in the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women's 2009 Femicide Report. Their stories detail severe emotional and physical abuse. My story differs in only that I survived it. After 17 years of experiencing verbal, emotional, and physical violence, as well as being isolated from any support or resources, I made the difficult decision to leave my marriage. My decision to leave in September 2008 came after I was brutally beaten, held hostage, and raped by my now late husband. I knew that choosing to leave the relationship would put me at a high risk for further escalated violence. But it was a risk I felt I had to take. I was determined to create a safe and healthy environment for my children and desperately wanted to experience peace after 17 years of turmoil. My husband did not let me leave quietly, though. He threatened me with further violence and death. While I took his threats seriously and acted to protect my family with the tools available to me, I could not have imagined what was yet to come. On February 20th, 2009, my late husband entered my home and attempted to murder my daughter and myself with a knife. This was the most terrifying day of my life, and one that will have lasting effects on my daughter and my entire family. Sadly, but thankfully, this was the day that my children and I had prepared for, We had talked through a safety plan and even created a code word that we would use to put the safety plan into action. Our code word was run. Our plan worked that day due to the quick and highly trained response of the Shakopee Police Department. My daughter and I survived it. So instead of having my name and story read by the others of the MCBW Femicide Report, I am here to share it with you today. The Shakopee Police Department listened and acted on the fear and gut feelings that I was experiencing that day. They also recognized and acted on the many high lethality indicators that were present. They did not make the assumption that my family and I were safe because we had managed to get out of the house and away from my husband. They knew that until they located him, we would not be safe. The Shakopee Police Department took the actions necessary to protect me, my children, and ultimately themselves. Before the life-changing events that occurred on February 20th, 2009, I found the help and support I needed from several agencies in Scott County. Southern Valley Alliance for Battered Women supported and helped me advocate for myself and my children. But Southern Valley Alliance has also been the catalyst for improving criminal justice systems response in Scott and Carver counties for more than 30 years. And I believe that their dedication, expertise, and relationship building helped to guide all of the systems that responded to save my life. The Scott County's Attorney's Office was persistent and committing to utilizing all the tools and laws available to keep myself and me safe. My attorney, Christine Anderson, worked for a reduced fee and provided me with the hope and strength that would be needed in the days to come. The Shakopee Police Department took my report seriously and encouraged me to call them if needed. In fact, all of these agencies were working in a coordinated way prior to February 20th, 2009, played an essential role in my family's survival that day. I am here alive today because the system as a whole believed me and gave me the tools I needed to realize that my children and I were lives worth saving. If legislators are committed to ending violence against women and children, they must also be committed to ensuring that all the systems that were available to me are adequately funded and trained so that every battered woman receives the life-saving response my children and I received. The program that was there for me receives less than $100,000 from the state of Minnesota. With that small amount of money, the program provides services to domestic violence victims across two large counties, including a crisis line, safe home network, community education, advocacy with community agencies, support groups, and criminal justice system advocacy, with only over three times staff equivalents, and 60 community volunteers. The program also somehow manages to provide criminal justice system intervention and supervised visitation center without any state funding. That one small program was the catalyst that made the whole system work and ultimately saved my life. I believe that every person in this state deserves to have the same life-saving responses. I have experienced what the small amount of money given to these programs can do. And based on that experience, I believe it is the best money that the state of Minnesota will ever spend. Every last one of you here today are my heroes. By supporting the people who are actively involved in my survival, you saved my life. And that of my 9-year-old child. I'm so grateful to each and every one of you. You don't even know. And it all starts here with you. So please don't cut our funding. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Powerful testimony on an afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to add to this particular issue? All right. Thank you. Mr. Erdman, are you here? There you are.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Ryan Erdman. I'm the Director and Legislative Liaison for the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. I'm also the Public Safety Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. and I am here today to speak with you a little bit about the sentencing to service cuts as proposed in the Department of Corrections budget. Having heard the testimony and your conversation in Monday's hearing, I don't have a lot to add about the value and the quality of the sentencing to service program throughout the state of Minnesota. I have a couple of thoughts that the corrections directors throughout the state have passed along to me that seem somewhat contradictory to that, though not necessarily. And that is, when considering cuts to counties, it tends to be our preference that cuts dedicated to specific programs be passed along versus cuts to the more broad funding, such as CCA funding or the CPO reimbursement. And the reason I say that gets back to your points, which I like very much, Madam Chair, about the nimbleness of counties. And if we have sort of those overall pots of money available, locals can make their decisions to direct those resources to the programs that are most beneficial to their communities. So should it be determined that there needs to be a county cut in some way, the dedicated funds may be our preferred area of cut versus some of the more general funds. That being said, I wanted to comment on what would happen across the state if sentencing to service funds were cut. And that's going to vary widely from county to county. In some counties, it will mean the end of the sentencing to service programs, particularly in greater Minnesota. In other counties, it'll mean substantial cutbacks. In Stearns County, I believe one of their three crews would probably go away based on the amount of funding they get from the state. In Hennepin County, the result would not be nearly as drastic. They have 32 STS crews, of which only two crews are funded out of state money. So it's going to be a varied response to that. Some counties may choose to backfill and see no cuts, even if they do have some state money. Others simply won't have the capacity to do that, given the broader base of cuts that they may see, including county program aid and other sources of county funding. And the last bit of information I would like to have considered in the debate is currently, by statute, essentially the workers' comp or the liability for these folks is carried by the state regardless of how the STS program is funded. So if the elimination of funding is going to come along with the elimination of the state assuming that liability, then that changes the conversation drastically, and STS is likely to go away in nearly every county throughout the state. So I would just like to throw that out there. I don't know how that would be handled. That would certainly be a decision to be made by you as a committee. But it would impact which counties. The smaller counties that may run a small-scale operation would not be able to do that any longer without that liability continuing to be assumed by the state. So with that, I would stand for any questions. We support STS greatly, and we would love to continue doing it in as many places as possible throughout the state.
Thank you. Commissioner Bray, would you come up to the table and we can talk about the workers' comp aspect? Thank you. Were you envisioning divesting yourself from the workers' comp aspect as Mr. Erdman talked about, or hadn't that been part of your decision in the cuts to SDS?
Madam Chair, Senators, I'd have to say we haven't wrestled with that yet. The figure we came up with of $3 million were cuts exclusively to the STS program. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure if workers' comp was figured in. I will check that for you. I don't think it was.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Any questions on either the corrections counties or sentence to serve? Thank you. Anybody else want to talk about sentence to serve that's in the audience? I suppose it's actually called sentencing to service, isn't it?
Sentencing to service, yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right, the last two people who asked to testify are Jan Graves and Dennis Grogan. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Janet Graves, RDSBH. As the first dental hygienist to work in our state's only maximum security prison at Oak Park Heights, I attained the distinction of being the only national certified corrections health provider in Minnesota State Corrections. Since Minnesota prisons have lost their accreditation in 2004, it's more important than ever for the legislature to exercise their authority of oversight of the DOC. In my expert opinion, the current situation in dental health services does not meet ethical or legal standards, but most disturbingly, is fiscally irresponsible. Given that evidence-based research links oral disease to systemic health problems, preventative and timely treatment of dental infection are crucial to maintain overall health and save money in the long run. Prior to the beginning of the 2009-2010 fiscal year, and just days after the legislature adjourned, DOC Director of Health Services Nan Larson slashed the dental care budget. Her decision was made in complete defiance of the legislature and the governor's funding decisions. Exactly where did the $1.24 million go? In testimony before this committee, DOC Director of Health Services was quoted, "We have waiting lists, but we are referring very few offenders outside for treatment. We're doing the best we can." Being a partner in deliberate indifference is not doing our best. Simply put, the dental waiting lists don't cut it, and neither does ignoring, denying, or delaying urgent dental treatment by looking the other way. The easiest way for an institution to lose a lawsuit is to fail to provide inmate patients with the prompt treatment of disease that its own staff has diagnosed. This practice is unethical, poor policy, and as I can personally attest, raises prison volatility and tensions. I don't buy the argument the DOC Assistant Commissioner Lisa Cordelius made when she said we wouldn't want the budget to be too specific. This agency needs budget flexibility. This situation is not about flexibility. It's about accountability for monies appropriated for services promised last spring. The discussion at that time was extensive. The conference committee's decision was clear, and yet the dental services were cut before the fiscal cycle even had a chance to begin. Last week, Senator Higgins and Senator Latz inquired where that appropriated money went to maintain dental services. A shoulder shrug. Response from not one but two DOC assistant commissioners was hardly the accountability that we were seeking. I urge the Senate committee to request a legislative audit of the DOC, specifically for DOC health services. Please, I respectfully remind this committee that restoring preventative and urgent dental services does not add to the state's budget deficit. It was decided last spring. It's simply directing the DOC to spend the money as appropriated by the legislature, the group given the charge of overseeing this agency in the first place. You know, it's been said that true ethical behavior happens when you think no one is looking. In the future, I suggest keeping a closer eye on the DOC, where the health services director ignores and defies the decisions of the legislature. Quite frankly, the DOC doesn't like to play by the rules. The choice is clear. Mandate the DOC to restore the preventative and urgent dental services as originally budgeted. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grogan, are you speaking as well?
As well. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for this opportunity to speak. My name is Dennis Grogan, and as a small business owner in the state, I have a few comments regarding the DOC and the budget proposals in front of the committee. I should be a familiar face in the room. I've attended virtually every committee meeting for the past 2 years. I've listened carefully, I've taken my notes, and I have conducted some of my own research. The governor's proposal to transfer money from MinCorp and from the DOC's special revenue funds does represent a 3% reduction from these accounts. And yet, 97% of the available funds remain. This leaves $50,537,000 in the MinCorps account. Even in the current economic downturn, I believe that that's a lot of money. The 2006 Legislative Auditor's Report revealed a gross margin between sales and cost of goods sold for MinCorps in fiscal year 2004 and in fiscal year 2005 of $15 million in each of those years. In other words, MinCorps is doing just fine. We do not have to worry about them coming up with the money to keep the inmates employed at $1 per hour. Perhaps this committee should consider requesting more than 3% from this fund to support some of the goals that we've heard from other groups today. However, the DOC special revenue funds are even more troubling. The 3% transfer leaves behind $19,497,000, a lot of unaccounted for monies squirreled away among a nebulous number of accounts. I've heard 25, I've heard as many as 30 various accounts. These little accounts, as Assistant Commissioner of Operations Lisa Cornelius refers to them, average, after the transfer, $779,000, these little accounts. Who controls these accounts? Where are these monies reported and recorded? And better yet, how and where are these funds being spent? After hearing extensive discussion last session about the excesses in the DOC Operations Division, specifically 75 full-time employees in finance and 65 full-time employees in IT, I'm curious how they are coming along with streamlining their division. So far, we've heard about reductions in community services and facilities, but no updates for the long overdue reductions in operations. The only written reference to the DOC Operations Division that I have found is found in the document titled 2010 Performance Target Report, which astonishingly calls for an increase in the number of full-time employees in operations from 174 in 2008 to a projected 230 full-time employees in 2010, an increase in 2 years of 32%. Full-time employees in this division. This growth hardly prepares the DOC for the leaner, post-federal, no federal dollar budgets that they will be living with in the next biennium. And I doubt that this is what the committee had in mind. This expansion was not what this committee had in mind last session when they set the budget. In closing, I've been hearing a lot about the attempts of the DOC to employ such business efficiencies, such as best practices, evidence-based decision-making, and now the new buzzword, Kaizen. In the face of budget deficits and diminishing funding, the projected expansion in DOC operations is not a reflection of best practices. Neither is the lack of standard accounting procedures in their special revenue funds accounts. I ask the committee members to join me in my curiosity, and I respectfully request two things: a full accounting of the current staffing level in the DOC Operations Division, and a limited legislative audit on the DOC's 25 to 30 slush fund accounts. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair, I actually have a comment in response to the testimony about the dental services.
Go ahead.
Not necessarily a question, but more a comment. You know, the Minnesota Nurses Association was on Capitol Hill earlier this week, and one of the nurses relayed to me, she's an emergency room nurse, a person who came in with an infected heart. It had started out as an infected tooth. Mm-hmm. And the infection was not treated. He didn't have insurance. He didn't go in and get care. The infection migrated through his body to his heart. It damaged it so badly he needed a new heart. So he ended up with a heart transplant. out of it. And then he got pneumonia while he was there because his body was so weakened, and then he had to spend 6 months or so in rehab after he finally left the hospital. So what would have been about, I don't know, a $250 treatment, maybe a course of antibiotics or pull a tooth, probably turned into $500,000 worth of medical care expenses. And so the very simple things like dental preventive care can certainly be the most cost-effective approach to things we do. And
Senator Lass, I really appreciate your comment. It's very, very difficult sometimes to get people on board with dental issues. It's also hard in the community with so many other people going without just basic medical care to have a lot of empathy with offenders. However, I will remind the committee and the DOC people sitting over here to the right and behind me that it's pretty much constitutionally dictated to that we maintain some level. What the Health Services Director has done makes absolute no sense. Yesterday I heard her speak before the House, and she was talking a lot about dialysis, hospice care, back at my home facility at Oak Park Heights. What can I say? Why bother putting a man on dialysis three times a week if he's sitting there with active dental infection? I hardly think sending an LPN, no offense to the LPNs, but I hardly think that an LPN ordering indiscriminate antibiotic and pain medication is appropriate treatment for people who have active dental disease. So I guess the take-home message here is what I really want you to embrace is that the DOC budget for healthcare is staggering. And none of it makes sense to me if you're not going to maintain minimal standards of dental health. Because believe me when I tell you, just as you testified, everything you're doing medically will be undone by active dental infection.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grogan. Anybody else want to talk to us about the governor's supplemental budget cuts? Going once? Going twice? Let's see. Next week, what's the plan next week? We're not meeting on Monday. Is that right? We're not meeting on Monday. And then before the Wednesday hearing, I'll have the chair's spreadsheet for our budget, and it won't be pretty. And we'll get it all to you before Wednesday so that you have a chance to look at it. And then I believe the request from the Finance Committee is for us to pass it to them so they have it by Thursday. So we'll be taking action on it on Thursday. We're taking action on it Wednesday. Excuse me.
That's all right. That's a long day.
Okay, we're done. We're adjourned. Thank you.